this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Downtown Land to Turn into $40 Million Project. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. For Raleigh businessman and philanthropist Gordon Smith III, it's been a long 4 years. Unraveling his downtown Raleigh real estate holdings per court orders and a 2009 bankruptcy reorganization plan, Smith on August 20 finalized the sale of one of his remaining prized properties, a two-acre city block at the corner of East Hargett Street and South Bloodworth Street that had already been cleared for future development. Records show Smith sold the property to a group of local and out-of-state developers for $4.34 million. The buyer group comprised of Raleigh investors John Florian and John Healy, along with Northbrook, Illinois-based Banner Apartments, are planning to build a four-story, 224-unit apartment building project called The Lincoln. The Lincoln project, ironically, is even larger than the 170-unit apartment community that Smith had originally planned to build on the site until neighbors concerned about its density forced him to rethink the project. Healy says his group hopes to break ground on the more than $40 million Lincoln apartment community before the end of the fourth quarter. The project's site plans received unanimous approval from the Raleigh Planning Commission on August 13. That's another big check mark. The project should complement redevelopment plans that the city of Raleigh has planned across the street on property the city also purchased from Smith. The city in June paid $3.7 million for a 1.7-acre site that Smith owned next to the Salvation Army and Raleigh Rescue Mission buildings on South Person Street. The city also is negotiating to buy the Salvation Army property for $2.1 million in hopes of redeveloping the site after the charity relocates to a larger location. This is going to give that side of downtown a shot in the arm, Healy says. Florian and Healy have been working on plans for the Lincoln since 2011, when Florian first put the land under contract. But as with anything in the court system, Healy says, it took longer than expected. It's kind of complex getting a property sold in Chapter 11, Smith says. He is on schedule with the reorganization plan for his real estate company, the Woodpile LLC, which had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in early 2009. At the time, the Woodpile listed liabilities of about $20 million and assets of about $12.6 million. I'm still working through it and making real progress, he says. Stephen Porterfield and Brett Muller of Capital Associates represented Smith in the sale of the Lincoln land. Smith still owns the Longview Center on East Hargett Street, a 1880s-era former church that he renovated for artistic performances. Smith was also a founder of the Downtown Raleigh Museum, now known as Marbles Kids Museum. And now we move to our cover story that has the headline, The Startup Race, Triangle Facilities Vie for Entries While Region Seeks Muscle to Compete Nationally. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge. Pop-up started in Chapel Hill, sort of. That's where, at Top of the Hill on Franklin Street, Dove Cohn first had that conversation, the one that starts, wouldn't it be neat if? In this case, the if was creating location-specific communication with an iPhone. What if you could deliver information or had something happen where, when a friend of yours walked into a place, what if you could leave him a note, Cohn says. Initially, Cohn was thinking about creating a game, but as the idea developed, so did his strategy, giving him enough confidence to apply to the Startup Factory, then known as the Triangle Startup Factory. The team was accepted, and late last year, Cohn found the confidence to quit his day job at Appia. It was a hard decision for me to make, Cohn says. After all, pop-up, like most startups, is still anything but revenue positive. Despite embarking on ambitious promotions, such as a new Durham scavenger hunt that allows explorers to uncover secret menu items and discounts at dozens of Durham businesses. The company, which completed a small, undisclosed angel round, had its own internal scavenger hunt in a few months, the search for venture capital. We're focused right now on growing our user base, he says, adding that he has sought out advice about raising money, something he expects to start doing later this year. It's going to be hard. It's hard work. But Cohn is lucky. along with Office Space Durham's The Startup Factory, armed him with mentors and other resources to tackle the increasingly competitive fight for venture capital. Now, PopUp is one of a cluster of startups housed in American Underground's newest extension at Main in downtown Durham. The goal, American Underground chief strategist Adam Klein says, is for entrepreneurs to start in at Main, move on to American Underground at American Tobacco, and eventually grow into a more independent space, joining the likes of Bronto Software and Burt's Bees in American Tobacco proper. But the odds are statistically stacked against startups, and the ones that are successful, they often land outside the triangle. Take Nolt, a startup formed by North Carolina State University grads Jeff Huber and Nash Yielding. Last year, the pair trucked their operations to San Francisco because they couldn't find funding in the triangle. And California isn't the Bull City's only competition. Raleigh, which hosts expanding co-working space HQ Raleigh, and will soon house an American Underground extension, has officially entered the startup battle. Raleigh versus Durham. In the round between the Oaks and the Bulls, Raleigh may be winning. That's the take of entrepreneurial researcher Vivek Wadhwa, who predicts Raleigh will outpace Durham in tech startups. It's because entrepreneurs prefer these small urban play areas where they can congregate, he says, and Raleigh fits the bill better than the likes of Durham and Chapel Hill. But that's not the big picture, local entrepreneurs insist. It's not Raleigh versus Durham, it's the triangle versus the world, and the playing field is changing. Raleigh isn't trying to take startups from Durham, insist Oak entrepreneurs. But when asked, the co-working spaces deny that there's any competition, even between co-working outfits. In fact, both Klein and Jason Wyden, executive director of HQ Raleigh and co-founder of ThinkHouse, say to question intra-regional competitiveness misses the point. Our visions are the same, says Wyden. We want the Triangle to be one of the top five entrepreneurial regions in the country, and that can't be done without working together. And he has a point, say entrepreneurs. James Sauls, director of Raleigh Economic Development, says each city has a different vibe. We're all part of a larger triangle, he says. Are you going to have friendly competition? Certainly, but it's what you do with that competition. There's a lot of places in the country that turn it into negative energy, but not here. Anil Chawla, CEO of Durham-based Archive Social, says the Triangle should treat entrepreneurship as entrepreneurs do in San Jose, as a regional effort. Come out here to Silicon Valley, he says. No one is sitting here debating between Palo Alto and Cupertino. They just call it Silicon Valley, and I don't see why we can't just call it the Triangle. But as Triangle entrepreneurs are consistently made all too aware, the Triangle is not Silicon Valley. While the Valley constantly lands in the top three on entrepreneurship lists, Raleigh isn't even in the top 10 as far as tech entrepreneurship goes. The Raleigh-Cary Metro is number 13 in a recent poll by the Kauffman Foundation, and pollster Engine Durham is number 22. And while Silicon Valley and Boston used to top entrepreneurship lists, now hubs like Boulder, Colorado are climbing. A lot more of this is happening outside of Silicon Valley, notes Mike McGarry, co-founder of List Author Engine. Now, because of these developing incubators, accelerators, because of the growth of angel networks and seed funding models and crowdfunding, there's a lot more opportunity for people in places such as Raleigh-Durham. Fierce competition. But Boulder, Fort Collins, and even Cheyenne, Wyoming are also competing for that opportunity. Boulder, notes McGarry, has the most startup companies per capita of any other place in the United States. That's the most intriguing part of this report, he says. This is a phenomenon that's growing everywhere. Derek Miner, innovation and entrepreneurship manager for the city of Raleigh, estimates that there are 300 early-stage startups in Raleigh alone, companies such as HQ's WedPix. That's people with ideas, he says. Maybe they're not quite at the revenue stage. And he classifies about 45 companies as early stage or growth stage companies, such as Lulu, Knowledge Tree. To Miner, there's no question that Raleigh can fill the slots being offered by the likes of American Underground. His question, will they be enough? And he says that's a big no. When you look at the total amount of offices that will be available between both spaces, about 50, that is small in comparison to demand, he says, pointing out that HQ currently has 6 offices with more than 30 companies on the wait list. But even the entrepreneurs are skeptical. I think it's going to be interesting to see, says Justin Miller, CEO of startup Wedpix, housed in HQ Raleigh. We do have a lot of people with ideas and a lot of people wanting to do things. I'm sort of hoping that with these newly available resources, that helps people make that transition from what they're currently doing. But the disparity between the number of idea stage companies and the number of growth stage companies may be the real issue. The Kaufman report that names Raleigh number 13 also takes an overall look at startup longevity. Early startups, those aged less than 1 year, actually create negative job growth because the overall forces of job destruction were greater than the forces of job creation. About half of all firms fail in their first 5 years of existence, erasing job gains of surviving firms. But young companies that do survive create robust job growth. High-tech startups, specifically, create jobs at twice the average rate. So how do you increase the number of companies that survive? You look at the commonalities. Those, according to Ted Zoller, director for the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, include strong leadership, evidence of a durable revenue stream, and long-term and high-quality investors who can attract downstream funding. The VC hunt. It's the last commonality that seems to cause the most headaches, that notorious hunt for venture capital. Unlike those in Silicon Valley, there's no Sand Hill Road for triangle entrepreneurs to walk down. When it comes to venture capital in North Carolina, it's an unsurprisingly bleak numbers game. In the past 4 trailing quarters, 1,208 companies were funded for a total of $10.3 billion in Silicon Valley. According to PricewaterhouseCoopers' Money Tree report, that's almost 50% more than North Carolina companies, where 40 deals brought in about $230 million, or about $5.75 million per company. No question, it's our challenge, says Zoller, and he believes the burst of new co-working spaces could help. They'll attract talent, which in turn will attract funds. It's a trend you'll see in any major evolving entrepreneurial ecosystem, he says. But entrepreneurs are growing impatient and are tired of hearing the reasons behind the lack of VC. Any investor who has any experience in this will tell you, if you want to be a serial entrepreneur, you don't do it in North Carolina, says Valencell CEO Steve LaBeouf. But LaBeouf, whose fitness monitoring technology company is nabbing its share of international accolades, headquarters his company in Raleigh anyway. One thing you do have here is you do have some really good talent that will stay, he says. One of the problems they have in the West Coast is sometimes it's hard to keep talent. But funding is a vital piece of the longevity puzzle, so entrepreneurs such as LaBeouf rack up frequent flyer miles if the investors won't come to you. You have to go to them, he says. We went everywhere. We went to the East Coast. We went to the West Coast. We went to Canada. We ended up getting investment from Best Buy in Minnesota, of all places. We were very aggressive. It's that type of aggression that allowed Miller and his Wedpix team to close on their first big round earlier this year, an oversaturated $1.1 million from the likes of Washington-based Brendan Family Growth Fund. Miller, who moved his team from his Cary basement to HQ Raleigh, does say it would be easier if Wedpix wasn't based in Raleigh. And as the company outgrows its small suite in HQ, moving is a possibility he's considering. We're a very big company, he says, of his growing team of 13 employees. We're in a space that's not really meant for companies of our size, so we've really surpassed the scale of where we should be for this space. And while he acknowledges there's other Class A office space to choose from, Wedpix wants to remain in a co-working atmosphere. The downside to having your own independent space, I think you lose out on a lot of those other opportunities, mentorship, collaboration, he says. But in the Triangle, he says, there aren't enough options at present. While he's looking at options here, including the new HQ Raleigh expansion, he sold his house earlier this summer to give him flexibility. Relocating is not out of the question, he says. I moved to a little house that I'm renting downtown now, really to enable that flexibility. Because opportunities happen, something he knows firsthand, last year he had a buy offer that would have moved his operations to Austin, Texas. I would have had 6 weeks to relocate, he says. While that seemed like an awesome opportunity, the reality of that set in. Not that he's specifically looking to move. He'd rather be an example that entrepreneurship can work here, he says. Chris Heavely, founder of the Startup Factory, says the big problem with funding in the Triangle is a lack of big exit stories. It's those publicized exits that bring in VC interest, he notes. We need more eye contacts and share files, he says, referencing big public buys last year of the Mooresville and Raleigh firms. Hopefully we're building them. It's going to take 3, 4, 5 years to get there. Wadhwa, however, says venture capital isn't holding Raleigh back when it comes to tech startups. VCs don't matter anymore, he says, pointing to successes such as Instagram. You don't need VC to have a startup. They can be funded on a shoestring. They cost less than a college education. And he points out most startups don't get venture capital. The odds of getting venture capital is actually higher in Raleigh than in Silicon Valley because there are fewer startups there, he says. Anywhere you go, you'll have the same problem. It's Raleigh's newly forming entrepreneurial community that might make all the difference, he says. I went to an incubator and I was delighted, he says, speaking to his last visit to Raleigh. It reminded me of my new home in Silicon Valley. As for Knowit, the Raleigh firm that blamed its 2012 exodus on a funding search, founder Jeff Huber lists formerly co-founder of Knowit on his personal website. Neither Huber nor Yielding would comment for this story. And along with this cover story article, there's also a list of startups to watch. And we'll go through that list. The first one is Boost Suite, co-founded by Aaron Houghton, who also co-founded iContact, one of the biggest startup exits thus far in the Triangle. Boost Suite, though, through leadership alone, is worth the watch, especially if history repeats itself. The company aims to help other companies maximize their web marketing results. Boost Suite says it can increase website visitors by 214%. Boost Suite is located in American Underground in Durham. BuyStand, with CEO Joe Davey at the helm, this company hopes to be the first to allow users to name their price. But the last buzzed-about company Davey founded, Evo App, went under. This time around, however, the company is betting that Davey has learned from his mistakes. Whatever happens, we'll be watching. Organic Transit. With its buzzed-about bike-car hybrids, Organic Transit is, without a doubt, the most visual of Durham startups. The brainchild of Rob Cotter, the company's ELF prototypes hit the market this year and may soon push the company from startup to growth stage. Archive Social, founded by Anil Chawla, the Durham startup is getting Silicon Valley attention, having just been accepted into the Code for America Accelerator, a four-month program focused on startups disrupting the state of technology in the public sector. Archive Social, which helps entities using social media comply with public record laws, is an alum of Triangle Startup Factory, now known as the Startup Factory, and is located in at Maine. And WedPix, this bridal-themed photo-sharing app, is among the big tech fundraising stories of 2013, having raised more than $1 million in venture capital. The 12-man team, including CEO and founder Justin Miller, moved from a Cary basement to HQ Raleigh this year. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. A quick glance at Triangle happenings. Mowing for dollars the hard way. For North Carolina Bankers Association CEO Thad Woodard, August 19 was a day he'd rather forget. It was raining, the wind was blowing sideways, and there were people under the Paragon Commercial Bank main canopy watching him intently. You see, Woodard was getting ready to cut the Paragon lawn with a hand mower, not because he had nothing to do, but because of charity. During the banking group's annual convention in June, Woodard had offered to cut the lawn to the highest bidder for a good cause, Camp Challenge, a summer camp for area students with limited resources. Paragon CEO Bob Hatley bid $700 and won the auction. Woodard thought he may have to cut Hatley's personal lawn, but I thought it would be more fun to cut a huge lawn that sits across from our offices, Hatley joked. All, of course, for a good cause, and a tip of the hat to Woodard for being a good sport. Broadhead holds his own with Colbert. Duke President Richard Broadhead got a pretty good jab at late-night talk show host Stephen Colbert. Broadhead was a guest for the Colbert Report, a show that mocks news on Comedy Central, on August 15, and the two discussed Broadhead's position as co-chairman of the Commission on the Humanities and Social Sciences, part of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which advocates arts and humanities education alongside science and math classes. After discussing the value of arts education, Colbert took a comedic turn and began to poke fun at the formatting of the report issued by the commission. A common joke among any college student who has ever tried to stretch the length of a term paper to meet the professor's page requirements. "I see you sprung for the fancy binder to try to get a better grade," Colbert begins. "But I want to point out something here. Look at the margins. Look at your margins right here. You clearly trying to stretch this. If you properly formatted this, this would be like 8 pages long." In a quick turnabout, Broadhead holds up one finger as if to say, "Wait a minute," and retorts, "All serious readers know that margins are to keep your notes in." The crowd bursts out in a loud, "Oh," to which Colbert replies, "Well, I'm glad I'm not a serious reader. I would feel bad that I didn't know that." The crowd got a good laugh at that interplay, but the two had more serious conversation about arts education as well. WakeMed opens ER facility in Garner. WakeMed Health and Hospitals opened a new $17 million standalone emergency department on Highway 70 in Garner, just off I-40. Called WakeMed Garner HealthPlex, the facility is connected to the WakeMed system and has a helipad for the most emergent cases that require helicopter transport. In addition to the 10-bed, 24/7 emergency department, the 50,000-square-foot facility will house lab and imaging services as well as physician offices. Carolyn Naup, WakeMed Senior Vice President of Ambulatory Services and Physician Operations, said most of the emergency cases start at 3 p.m. and run through the night, but the facility will look to perform scheduled procedures in the morning to keep up patient volumes. WakeMed estimates 12,000 to 15,000 during the first year. The addition of the new HealthPlex created 175 new jobs, and many of the employees live in or near Garner. Bullock snags big fish in Hawaii tourney. A big aloha to iCare Associates CEO Steve Bullock, whose Old South Marlin Club team took the first prize in a few days ago at the Hawaiian International Billfish Tournament held in Kona, Hawaii. Bullock and his team of six anglers, including C.J. Dugan, the lead fisherman and a member of the U.S. Army, were way behind in the standings until the last day of the five-day tournament, where they caught a 588-pound blue marlin after fighting the fish for 54 minutes. A reporter at the West Hawaii Today newspaper tells Biz that there was no prize money at this tournament that charges $7,500 to register a team. There were 38 teams from 10 countries. Here's an illuminating deal. Durham's own Square One Bank is extending an undisclosed credit facility to fuel Atlanta-based LED display manufacturer NanoLumens. The proceeds of this new credit facility will help us to better meet the rapidly growing demand for our solutions while we continue to develop a host of new products for both current and new markets, says Rick Cope, NanoLumens president and CEO. Square One typically invests in growth companies, and one of its last deals, a facility to Morrisville's Advanced Liquid Logic, proved sound. ALL, last month was acquired by San Diego-based Illumina. Contributing to Biz were staffers Lauren Onsorge and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. Starting off with an article written by Lauren K. Onsorge, the headline, NC Stepping Up Plans to Recruit More VC Funds. Venture capitalists are looking for deals. Startups are looking for cash. What should be synergy is clouded by the sheer number of startups, 300 in Raleigh alone. It's a lopsided dilemma that's making that cash ever harder to come by. The solution? Recruiting more venture capital. It's a topic that has been discussed everywhere from the legislature to the governor's mansion. And one woman may have a way to do it, Janet Cowell. The North Carolina State Treasurer in 2010 initiated the Innovation Fund, $232 million of the state's $80 billion fund. The money, $50 million of which is still left to invest, is targeted at private equity funds investing in companies with a nexus in North Carolina, she says. And it's one of the ways government is trying to attract venture capital to the state. When I came into office, obviously we had just experienced a downturn in the economy, Cowell says. And that led to creative thinking about job creation, she says. That's why she started having conversations with other states about their own innovation fund-like project. We were able to learn the best practices, she says. While the fund is already seeing 50% returns under Credit Suisse management, it has already invested in firms such as Durham-based Hatteras Venture Partners. It's hard to say how much venture capital it has actually recruited to the state, she says. Her office is evaluating that and job creation in order to decide whether to embark on a second innovation fund. Cowell has had several conversations about venture capital recruitment, including one with former University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Chancellor Holden Thorpe, who seemed to think the problem was talent. It's another interesting perspective that there's not enough people in the business world that truly understand the science and the technology, she says. He talked of that being more of the challenge that the best firms can get funding. In other words, strong leadership, both of the scientific and the managerial quality. Could the lack of venture capital be weeding out weaker players that don't fit the bill? Ted Zoller, director for the Center of Entrepreneurial Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, says he and other entrepreneurial promoters aren't trying to create more startups. They're trying to create more growth stage companies, and they're doing it by fostering idea stage firms and giving them the tools to stand out as strong players. That's where accelerators such as Launch Chapel Hill and the Startup Factory come in. The commonalities he sees among surviving companies? Strong leadership, particularly from successful serial entrepreneurs. Effective customer channels. Evidence of a revenue stream. Effective marketing strategy, and strong investors. Most of those commonalities come with experience and mentorship. And we have a quick note in the Triangle Business Journal. TBJ's new ME is former business lawyer, it's headlined. Rebecca Troyer has joined the Triangle Business Journal team as its managing editor. Troyer was a practicing business attorney for 15 years before becoming a columnist, editorial writer, and business reporter at the Herald Times in Bloomington, Indiana. Most recently, she was the opinion editor at the Tribune-owned Daily Press in Newport News, Virginia, where she was responsible for writing daily editorials and planning and editing the opinion content on digital and print platforms. She is the recipient of numerous awards for stories and editorials and was recently named one of three national finalists for two major awards, the 2012 Scripps Howard Walker Stone Award for Editorial Writing and the American Society of News Editors 2013 Burl Osborne Award for Editorial Leadership. Troyer is a Raleigh native and graduated from Broughton High School. She attended the Indiana University School of Music and the IU School of Law in Bloomington, Indiana. While in Indiana, she was an adjunct faculty member at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs, teaching an undergraduate course in law and public policy. Troyer replaced Dale Gibson, who retired earlier this month. And now we turn to the reporter pages. The first one we come to is Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. The headline on the first article, Highwoods sees sunnier forecast. Ed Frisch, president and CEO of Highwoods Properties, was in a particularly good mood when we caught up with him by phone on his way back to the airport in New York earlier this week. Frisch was coming out of a day of meetings in the Big Apple with the credit rating agencies, an annual ritual, and since both Standard & Poor's and Moody's had increased the company's credit ratings earlier this summer, the meetings went pretty well, he said. We feel good about what we've been able to generate this year in what is still a trying economy for some, Frisch said. Raleigh-based Highwoods Properties, the largest office landlord in the Triangle, and one of the largest suburban office real estate investment trusts in the Southeast, has had a particularly busy few months with several major acquisitions, dispositions, and development projects announced in Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Orlando, and Tampa. The company also raised $151 million through a public offering of 4.3 million shares on August 14. The sale was underwritten by Wells Fargo Bank and Jefferies LLC, a wholly owned subsidiary of Leucadia National Corporation, as part of a pre-negotiated bought deal where the underwriters buy all the shares. Frisch says the whole transaction took about 12 minutes. Opportunities to buy and sell commercial properties have been stronger than executives had anticipated at the beginning of the year, he says. The company had originally forecast selling between $100 million and $150 million of office and industrial properties in its portfolio in 2013. But that forecast has since been revised upward to between $190 million and $225 million. Opportunities for acquisition have been revised from $200 million to $328 million earlier this year to between $400 million and $550 million. Development opportunities have been revised from $75 million to $200 million to between $125 million and $235 million in 2013. Highwoods has two major Triangle office development projects in the pipeline, the 165,000-square-foot Glen Lake 5 office building planned at Highwoods Glen Lake Office Park in West Raleigh, and a trio of buildings at a new office park, Weston Lakefront in Cary. Frisch isn't ready to say his company is ready to build its next major office building in the Raleigh market, but he's clearly lining up his cards. Detailed site plans for the Glen Lake 5 building were filed with the Raleigh Planning Department in late July, and the Cary Town Council approved plans for the 670,500-square-foot Weston Lakefront project in July. Frisch says timing of Glen Lake 5 will depend a lot on interest from tenant prospects and suspects and how that weighs against development activity in other Highwoods markets. Regarding Weston Lakefront, which many speculate is being designed for a long-term tenant deal with MetLife to accommodate its expansion plans, Frisch would only say, no comment. And on Amanda Hoyle's page, we also have a sneak peek section with a picture of the interior of Waverly Place in Cary. The owners of the Waverly Place Retail Center in Cary have been working to revive the once vibrant shopping center at the corner of Kildare Farm and Tryon Roads. And this week they announced a 20-year anchor lease for a luxury movie theater and restaurant by next summer. Cobb Theaters of Birmingham, Alabama, has leased a 35,000-square-foot space on two floors where it will open its Cine Bistro in North Carolina. According to Cobb's chief operating officer, Jeremy Wellman, Cine Bistro is a hybrid of a luxury-style movie theater with spacious high-back leather rocking chairs and a casual dining restaurant with its own executive chef. The Waverly Place Theater is expected to have six auditoriums that will each have about 85 seats. Reservations will be recommended. Tickets cost about 20 to 40% more than at a traditional movie cinema. Families are welcome at showtimes before 6 p.m., but the dinner crowd is typically 21 years old or older since alcohol is being served. We are very serious about our food, he says. The core menu offered at most Cine Bistros features entrees with salmon, steak fillets, seasonal dishes, and creative salads, he says. There's no squeeze cheese nachos here. It will employ about 100 people when it opens. The concept of bringing more food options to movie theaters has been catching on across the country. Locally owned Raleighwood Cinema Grill in North Raleigh offers a similar service but on a more casual scale. And now we're on the page of Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. The headline of his article, Nursing Bed Count Likely Static Through 2017. Five nursing care facilities, including one operated by UNC Healthcare, each applied on August 15 for permission to build a new 90-bed nursing facility in Chatham County. The state, through the Department of Health and Human Services, regulates various health services, including how many nursing beds each county may have, and determines which organization may build the new facility. Groups file what is called a Certificate of Need application with the state, and regulators make their decision based on the quality of those applications. Groups that are not awarded the facility may appeal. As of last year, the statewide nursing care bed inventory totaled 43,606 licensed beds in nursing homes. The state also regulates hospital-based nursing beds, which number 1,913 in the state, including 120 at the Rex Rehabilitation and Nursing Care Center of Raleigh. The state initially determined that the 90 in Chatham County would be the only new beds allowed in the state, but allowed an additional 40 in Guilford County as well, in response to a petition by the Bell House. In its proposed plan for 2014, the state does not allow for any new beds and does not anticipate a need for more beds anywhere in the state through at least 2017. Naturally, the state's primary basis for how many nursing beds are allowed in a particular area is the age of that population. For example, the state figures only 0.61 beds per 1,000 population 65 years and younger, but nearly 93 beds per 1,000 population 85 years and over. For ages 65 to 74, the state's methodology calls for 7.76 beds per 1,000 population. For ages 75 to 84, the state figures 26.12 beds per 1,000 population. And also on this page, we have a note on a new chief at UNC Cancer Center. That's the headline on this short section. Dr. Norman Sharpless was appointed director of the University of North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center effective January 1. Sharpless succeeds Dr. Shelton Earp, who will continue as director of UNC Cancer Care, coordinating cancer care and research across the School of Medicine, the university, and UNC Healthcare System. Sharpless was named Innovator Researcher of the Year in 2012 by the TBJ. He helped found G1 Therapeutics, previously G0 Therapeutics, which is developing a new cancer treatment and has raised more than $1 million in debt and equity financing. Ned is a star in the world of oncology, says Dr. Marshall Rung, Executive Dean of the School of Medicine. He is not only a renowned physician and researcher, but a great leader as well. Sharpless, an honors graduate of the UNC School of Medicine, is currently Wellcome Distinguished Professor of Cancer Research, Professor of Medicine and Genetics, and Lineberger's Deputy Director. And now we're on the page of Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. In one section, we have an area marked called He Said, She Said, and it has words from two local leaders. The first is Jay Parker, president of Lenovo North America. Could smartphones be made in North Carolina? We asked Jay Parker, president of Lenovo North America, following an earnings report that showed the Chinese company's combined smartphone and tablet sales had overtaken those of its PCs. Parker, who says Lenovo is still committed to bringing its smartphones to the U.S. in 2014, says the Whitsett facility is already capable of making the phones. We've already started manufacturing tablets there. And Lenovo's commitment to North Carolina? Nothing has changed, he says. As we scale, we expect the Whitsett facility to scale and to produce more and more PCs. And the Morrisville headquarters will grow accordingly, he adds. And the other side of the he said, she said, is Delisa Alexander, Chief People Officer at Red Hat. Red Hat Chief People Officer Delisa Alexander says there's a side effect to Raleigh's growing popularity with tech companies, and it comes in the form of recruitment competition. I definitely have heard tales of some of our new technology competitors for talent. Beginning to see a lot of interest in Red Hat's employees, she says. To some extent, it's kind of a proud moment. We used to be a company that nobody knew who we were unless you were a techie or a hacker. The Red Hat name didn't mean much to the mainstream. But no longer. Now we've got such a great reputation, she says, and that leads to a new set of challenges. People want our talent. Other companies and other associations are seeking what Red Hat associates have. And now we're going to read from the Triangle Business Journal's People on the Move section, which has a People Spotlight. And this spotlight is on Chris Romick, Executive Director of Searstone Continuing Care Retirement Community. Armed with a degree in gerontology administration, Chris Romick has been tapped as executive director of Searstone Continuing Care Retirement Community, giving him what he calls a pinnacle opportunity in his career. The Searstone community is currently under construction in Cary after being on the drawing board since 1998. The CCRC is expected to open its doors on November 1, Romick says. Operating as a CCRC, Searstone will provide independent living, assisted living care, and skilled nursing care all within the same community. The 169-unit community is currently 88% reserved, Romick says, and hiring is being ramped up. Searstone has just shy of 10 employees now, but that number is expected to grow to more than 100 in the next few months. As executive director, Romick is charged with the oversight duties of all operations. This includes developing and managing the dining, wellness, and fitness programming, nursing, groundskeeping, social work and security, and transportation functions of the community. Romick is responsible to Searstone's board of directors and to David Ammons and Kyle Dilday of Retirement Living Associates Incorporated, the management partner for the community. Background. Romick was born and raised in northeastern Ohio. After a tour in the U.S. Navy, he enrolled in Kent State University, where he received a bachelor's degree. The program at Kent State prepared Romick for a career as a licensed nursing home administrator. Upon graduation, he joined a small corporation that owned a group of nursing homes in Ohio. For the past 16 years, Romick has been involved with startup communities in four states and turnaround projects in several more. At one point, he was a part owner of an upscale assisted living project in Ohio. In more recent years, Romick has concentrated exclusively on CCRCs through ground-up development, opening, and operating. Romick has been at his current post for about 2 months. Education. Bachelor's degree in gerontology administration from Kent State University. Goal. The first goal of Searstone is to bring Mr. Sears' vision to reality, Romick says. There is no doubt that our goal is to make Searstone a standard for all other retirement communities to measure themselves by for many years to come. Personal. Romick and his wife Gina have two children, Emma and Olivia. And now we're going to read from the viewpoint section of the Triangle Business Journal. And we're going to read a guest column entitled Personal Journey to Self-Publishing. And this was written by Candace Austin. Is there a career to be made in self-publishing novels? The answer to this question depends upon the answers to two more questions. Have you written an outstanding novel, a novel that is loved by many people, people with no stake in your sanity and little empathy for your feelings? If you have, are you willing to put in a hefty amount of time to market the novels yourself? I recently self-published my first novel after playing the querying game with New York City literary agents for 2 years. I came close, gave exclusives on the full manuscript, but ultimately no signed contract. One agent left me with this, however. I truly believe a lot of people will love your books, and this was the push I needed to take my future into my own hands. The times, they are changing in publishing. In 2012, Boker Books in Print and Identifier Services reported that the number of self-published books is up 287% since 2006. And in 2011, 43% of all printed books were self-published. It's an exciting time for indie book authors, but what does it take to rise to the top of the 250,000 self-published books in the digital marketplace? I'm hoping to find out and to share what I find. Here's what I've done thus far in my journey. Kindle Direct Publishing published my ebook to Amazon's Kindle Bookstore. Amazon's CreateSpace produces the paperbacks on demand and makes them available on Amazon. And Smashwords published the ebook in additional file formats for Nook and other e-readers. All of this took me approximately 16 hours of formatting and submitting my manuscript for each point of delivery. I wouldn't say it was a piece of cake, but if I can do it, you can do it. And it cost me less than $15. Now, I'm a graphic designer and a copywriter, so I was able to design my own cover, but CreateSpace and others offer art services for purchase or templates at no cost. I sent the files off on a Saturday. The proof shipped the following day. That same day, my ebook became available on Amazon. And on Wednesday, my proof arrived. It was gorgeous. It was fast. The quality was amazing. And I was happy to see that it was printed in Charleston, South Carolina. Go USA. Mind you, the time I've put into the novel heretofore spans 2 years. 2 years of half listening to my poor husband, ignoring the dog, and feeding my kids sandwiches for dinner. And that's nothing compared to the time I'm about to spend marketing this thing that I love. Reviews are what you want first. Be honest, when you're searching for a book online, do you check the reviews? I do. I announce my novel on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and via email, and within weeks, friends emailed me to say that they'd read it and loved it. I encouraged them to review and share. Next, I printed business cards for my book, cover art, description, my website, and where to buy the novel. Did I say website? Yes, you need to have an author, website, or blog. I used GoDaddy's website builder after fishing around for the easiest program. I used Tumblr.com for my blog. And now for the daunting part, online promotions and networking. There are book bloggers, reviewers, magazines, and more to seek out. And it's ideal to have multiple titles out there, so I need to edit my other novels, create covers, sigh, but right now my 3-year-old wants to play dinosaurs. It's true, you have to take time from everything in your life to write, but you can write and make time for everything in your life, and hopefully make some decent income doing it. We'll see. And at the end, here's a tip. Self-publishing podcasts and blogs often recommend creating your list for Amazon's Listopia with your book and like-kind bestsellers included. Amazon is removing this ability. Stay tuned. And also on our Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a guest opinion. And this guest opinion is from Nicola Green, who is the president of the Washington Area Women's Foundation. The headline on the guest opinion, again, sequester anyone? On a recent weekday at an adult education center in D.C., a group of students learned the definition of a new word, sequester. It was written on a dry erase board in a classroom where adults who had not graduated from high school were preparing to take the GED test. Many of them struggled to make ends meet, and passing the test would enable them to move on to higher education and get a better job, something that would greatly improve the lives of their families. It is these families that are most devastated by the sequester. Since its implementation 6 months ago, it feels like the sense of urgency to resolve the impact of the sequester has dissipated. It's no longer front-page news and has become the source of jokes and derision. There was the non-snowquester in March, the sparring about what was really behind the cancellations of all White House tours, and the reports about how Congress quickly passed legislation to resolve the impact of the sequester on air travel, just as their week-long recess was beginning. All the while, critical social services that are helping to meet the needs of our most vulnerable families are being cut. Nationally, reductions in funding for Head Start, the early education program that serves low-income families, will mean an estimated 70,000 children won't be able to attend the federally funded preschools. Those same cuts will likely cost more than 11,000 Head Start teachers their jobs. MSNBC recently reported that the sequester cut funding for housing vouchers by $854 million, even though since 2009 there's been a 19% increase in the percentage of households most in need of assistance. And the elderly have also been hit by a 2% cut to payments to Medicare providers, reductions in funding for energy assistance programs, and significant cuts to Meals on Wheels. 1 in 7 seniors is threatened by hunger. And all of these cuts disproportionately affect women and children, who make up the majority of people living in poverty. Although the hype has faded, for many people, the very real implications and impact of these policy decisions are just beginning. For them, the sequestration is tantamount to devastation. Hundreds of thousands of people have been affected by cuts to programs like those listed above. Poor people in this country are once again bearing the brunt of bad policy and are finding that their pathways out of poverty have been blocked. And the sequester isn't only affecting people who rely on social services. There are also large swaths of the federal workforce that have been required to take mandatory furloughs or who have been laid off. A chief economist for Moody's Analytics told The Hill that one quarter of the federal workforce, nearly 1 million people, will be furloughed for an average of 13 days through September. All of these cuts are being made to ease the financial strain on the federal government, but you have to wonder what the average person is supposed to do to ease her own financial strain. Sequester is bad policy that will prevent more Americans from lifting themselves out of poverty. Our lawmakers need to start putting the needs of those who are most disadvantaged first instead of last, and try to put themselves in the shoes of those who are most profoundly impacted by the policy decisions they are making or not making from on high. And now we come to the section in the Triangle Business Journal. In case you missed it, pictures from selected events around the Triangle in the past week. The first picture, headlined Women in Business, shows a woman very well dressed, standing at a lectern, speaking to people. And underneath it says, Triangle Business Journal's 2013 Women in Business Awards brought women and their shoes to Durham. The well-heeled crowd, pun intended, was made up primarily of the area's female business leaders, such as Trademark Property CEO Billy Redman. Standards were high, and those taking home the commemorative Glass Slipper Award were more than worthy. Along with being recognized for their accomplishments, women brought more than 120 pairs of shoes for nonprofit Dress for Success Triangle, which helps low-income women gain and maintain employment. And the second one is Durham Bulls Athletic Park, and it's a picture of Chipper Jones. And underneath the picture it reads, The Durham Bulls, the once Class A affiliate of the Atlanta Braves, had Chipper Jones on hand as it retired his number on Tuesday. Though he only played 70 games with the Bulls in 1992, Jones drew a standing-room-only crowd at the ceremony, which took place on Goodman Field just prior to the Bulls' matchup against the Charlotte Knights. What was his reaction to the news that his number was being retired by the Bulls? I couldn't believe it, to be honest, Jones said. I think I only hit 270 when I was here, but I did hit the Bull for a steak dinner. I was obviously very flattered. I had a great time here. For the Durham Bulls to retire the number 10, I am very honored. And in our last few minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Smithfield shareholders to vote on Chinese takeover at September 24 meeting. Smithfield Foods Incorporated has scheduled a shareholders meeting for September 24 to vote on the company's proposed takeover by the Chinese firm Shuanghai International Holdings. Smithfield Foods filed a proxy statement on Tuesday noting that ballots will be mailed to all those who own shares of Smithfield Common Stock as of August 5. The Smithfield Board of Directors in May approved the proposal for the $4.7 billion merger agreement. The deal values Smithfield at $7.1 billion after including the company's debt. If approved, the deal would be the largest takeover of a U.S. company by a Chinese firm. McCrory signs Hospital Pricing Transparency Bill into law. Hospitals must now submit prices for 140 of their most common procedures after Governor Pat McCrory signed a bill to increase hospital pricing transparency. Immediately, the North Carolina Hospital Association responded that although this might make consumers more aware of costs, it does nothing to actually lower costs of health care. All health care facilities, but mainly hospitals, have long complained that they must charge private payers more than the actual cost for health care because they must offset losses from Medicaid and charity care patients. Across the state, hospitals lost $150 million just for treating Medicaid patients last year, says Don Dalton, an NCHA spokesman. As long as the state does nothing to address payments for those who have no insurance, costs will continue to rise on businesses and patients who fund health care, he says. Google designates Cary a 2013 E-City. Cary just bested both Raleigh and Durham as North Carolina's digital capital, at least according to Google. The search engine giant has named Cary its 2013 e-city for the state of North Carolina, a designation that recognizes the strongest online business community in each state. Cary's growth and innovation in e-commerce is an example that other cities across the state can strive to replicate, says Scott Levitan, director of small business engagement at Google. Other winners include Boulder, Colorado, Carlsbad, California, North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. Wells Fargo cutting 48 jobs in Raleigh. Wells Fargo & Company is laying off 48 workers in Raleigh as part of a nationwide purge that affects 2,323 employees. The San Francisco-based bank issued 60-day notices to the impacted Raleigh employees on Wednesday. The nationwide round of layoffs is isolated to mortgage lending jobs, which is the result of a slowdown in demand for mortgage refinancing. While interest rates remain very favorable by historical standards for homebuyers and lenders, the fast-paced consumer demand for mortgage refinancing we experience throughout the 2012 and early 2013 is slowing, Wells spokesman Josh Dunn said in a statement. The company is working with affected workers on transfer opportunities and separation benefits. Wells Fargo is also cutting 284 jobs in Charlotte. And as our time is winding down, we'll stop right there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast, and you can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.